RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
If you were listening to our Bytes News on Friday morning, you would have heard our lead story. Government report undermines rationale for vaccine mandates in health and education. I'll read the first paragraph of that story before we go any further. New Zealand teachers speaking out with science, that's NZTSOS, have uncovered a Ministry of Health Science and Insights report from October 2021 that undermines the Labor government's claims about the significant risks of COVID-19 transmission in schools and healthcare settings at the time. So what does this mean? We've invited Mike Shaw, who is spokesperson for NZTSOS, and Bruce Gillart, a researcher for NZTSOS, onto the program. Hi, Mike. Thanks for coming on.
Hello, Paul.
And Bruce, thank you.
Hi, Paul.
What is this find that I just mentioned from our news on Friday? What is it?
Well, perhaps to put it in context, Paul, is we've been preparing for our appeal to the Supreme Court and getting stuff ready with our legal advisors, Frontline Law. And it's something really that Bruce began to become aware of, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong, Bruce. You'd seen something in the when the churches went to court to challenge the mandates, and there was a kind of like a contradictory report from Dr. Towns, basically saying, and from my understanding, is that in that situation, the government's position was churches are different from schools. Schools are less likely to get infected. You're more likely to get infected with COVID if you go to church and you're singing and you're in close proximity. And in that context, there was a paper about the secondary infection rates at school. Is that kind of how it came up, Bruce?
Yeah, absolutely. The community church case, they were arguing that churches and schools should be treated the same, both mass gatherings and whatever. And the government was arguing, no, that churches are much worse than schools. And Dr. Town used this study, which I'd never come across before, which caught my attention because this study was showing that schools had very, very low rates of transmission in them. And so I searched the internet to try to find the study and could not find any reference to it. Actually, I could find one reference to it as a reference in another study, but was not available. And so I did a Freedom of Information request, and we've got our own copy of this report now, which I think is pretty significant on many fronts.
Okay. Do you want to go through the significance then in the fronts, the many fronts? Tell us about that.
Well, I guess for the report, we need to, is it relevant is the first question, and is it robust is the second question. And as far as the relevance go, does it talk about transmission? Because the mandates are all about transmission. And yes, it talks about transmission. Does it talk about the Delta variant? Because the courts have told us, don't worry about Omicron. It was Delta that was in the community when the government brought in the mandate. So we only need to consider Delta. And yes, it's all about Delta. And does it talk about the New Zealand scene? Yes, it's about the New Zealand scene. And does it talk about, or does it look at transmission in schools in the New Zealand scene? Yes, it does. And did the government have it in its possession before they signed the mandate? Yes, they did have it in their possession. And so it ticks all their boxes as far as relevance. And in fact, I have not come across anything that is as relevant as this. There's nothing else that ticks all those boxes. And so I would argue it is highly relevant to the government's position. And the second question of, is it robust? That comes down, I guess, to the size. And it's not a sample because every bit of contact tracing data between August and October, certain dates, were put on a database and now have been analysed by the Ministry of Health. And this is the result of that analysis of all this contact tracing data. There was 790 different index cases, people who were infected. And they had contact with over 41,000 different people in that time. And all of this data has been analysed to work out how many people got infected from the primary index cases, working out what they call the secondary attack rate, which is simply a measure of infection or transmission, rather. And so if their secondary attack rate was 50%, and if I was infected and sat in a room with 100 people and half of them got infected, it would be 50%. If I sat in a room for 15 minutes with 100 people and only one got infected, that would be a secondary attack rate of 1%. And what they found was in schools, the secondary attack rate of all the, from all their data was only 0.1%. Wow. In other words, only 1 in 1,000 contacts became infected from someone who was in school and was infected.
And that information was available to decision makers, the decision around mandates before they made that series of decisions, let's say.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The timeline is interesting because the first reference to an education mandate is when Hipkins talks about Monday the 4th of October. He had a meeting with education officials and they proposed the idea of a mandate to him. They had been talking to the unions and they proposed the idea. It did not come from health departments at all. It came from the Ministry of Education.
Okay, that's curious because they have no knowledge of health matters, do they?
Professionally, well, they're not health experts.
No.
But 1 week later, so that was the 4th of October, give them 4 working days, the Ministry of Education then brought a cabinet paper to cabinet to recommend mandating all of teachers and education workers, and cabinet agreed to that. So between the first mention of the whole thing, which was October the 4th, and the government agreeing to the whole thing, which was October the 11th, is 1 week exactly, or four working days between the two. It is amazing.
Mike, do you have any thoughts on the interaction between Ministry of Education, the unions, and Ministry of Health, and Hipkins himself?
Yeah, we can only really speculate as to what would be the motivation of the Education Department and the Ministry of Education and the unions to go to the government with a proposal to mandate, you know, not based on health advice or scientific evidence. And, what you come up with, I don't know, as to what the real motivation was, whether it was virtual signaling or something else, but only they really know. But whether it's just to, I mean, we had the overall goal to get the vaccination rates up. You got a lot of employees in the education sector. So we're hoping it wasn't something like that, just to get the vaccination rates up on a population of workers. Teachers, generally speaking, are quite compliant, not to be offensive, but you know, they've been through teachers' training college. You know, they've been indoctrinated with different ideologies that come from the government. They repeat those ideologies in their classrooms. I don't want to throw any slights on my colleagues, but that's kind of the environment that perhaps they were working with. Why come and lay that at the feet of Hipkins without the medical advice?
From my perspective, I think the government had got itself into a bit of a pickle because they had created this great fear of this beast that called COVID, and so many parents were so scared to send their kids to school unless they got this beast. And especially the Auckland had been in lockdown. They needed some magic bullet to kill the beast. And that magic bullet was, well, let's vaccinate all the teachers. And now we can say the beast is dead and you can send your kids to school without fear. And so I think the motivation was to get kids back to school because so many were missing out on education through the fear of not being in contact with other people.
The involvement of the unions then, because we know there's a close relationship, don't we, between Labor Party and the teacher union. So would that speak to your point you've just made, Bruce, do you think?
Yeah, well, like many teachers, when they were being terminated, they were crying out to the unions, help us. We've been paying our union dues, you know, all our lives as teachers. Now's your time to help us. And they were surprised when the unions basically said, sorry, you're on your own. And we now know why that is the case, because the unions have been behind the whole thing. They were recommending to the Ministry of Education and working in cahoots with them to actually bring in the mandate. they were actually advising principals. The union was advising principals on how to sack their members.
Wow.
They were giving legal advice to principals, hosting legal seminars on how to basically get rid of people who would not comply.
But they knew of the existence of this information, I'm assuming. Did they? While that was happening. Did they? Do we know that?
Well, this was published on October the 19th. And so Cabinet agreed on October the 11th. This was published on October the 19th. And the mandate order was then signed, I think it was on October the 25th. And so this was published, they knew about it, before the order was signed. There was still time for the government to say, wait a minute, the beast is already dead. There's no beast at all. We don't need to panic here because transmission in schools is almost non-existent. Don't worry, people, come back to school because we now know that there's no risk of transmission. But I think they buried that report because that would have put a problem on their whole narrative about the fear to do with COVID. That's my take on it.
Transmitted to everyone, not just teachers. There'll be questions asked if that information was known, right? Everyone would be saying, well, wait on, if only you know, 1,000 to 1 chance of this, why are we all being sort of trying to frog march us to something where there is a very low risk? It's a can of worms, potentially.
Yeah, well, some settings had much higher risks, like households. Their secondary attack rate, I think, from memory, was 47%. So in other words, about 500 times higher than in schools. And so being in a household, your risk of getting it from someone else is fairly high. Mm. And various other settings had other rates, but the schools were one of the lowest. Bringing in our medical colleagues too, the secondary attack rate in healthcare settings was only 0.2%. So it, again, was pretty insignificant. And so the whole medical need for the medical workers mandate is also brought into question as well.
Mike, it sounds like, you know, a huge effort in stage management.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That, you know, shuffling papers around, you like kind of like pick a card, that sort of stuff, like a magician's trick, really.
Well, they call it bait and switch.
Something like that, yeah. And the climate of fear that they generated, I think, you know, through TV and what have you. We had staff members up here in the north kind of feeling like if they didn't get vaccinated, they'd be responsible for the community getting wiped out.
Yeah, boy.
And it was terrible, but not based on any kind of reality.
What about the role of Hipkins, though? He's was involved in other decisions that may not age too well. Is he part of this at all?
Well, he wasn't an expert witness, so he's not under the same legal obligation as the expert witnesses are. He has obviously an ethical obligation.
Well, he knew of that information.
Surely.
And he could have stopped that happening.
Yeah, we would expect that he would have been fully briefed with all the relevant stuff. I mean, this is a Ministry of Health study. He's the guy. Surely he was aware of it.
And if he wasn't confident in the study, surely he could have asked for or delayed it, seeking more time to get to the bottom of whether the study is good or not. The fact that they used it later on in the Areva court case means they had confidence in it by the time they got to a couple of months later with Areva. It's strange they didn't have confidence in it at the time to use it in our case when he did. Dr. Town did talk about another similar study from New South Wales schools that was much, much smaller, and where over half the contacts, I think about two-thirds of the contacts, were all in preschool settings. And he did use that to show the court that the secondary attack rate there was 4.7%, I think it was, from memory.
Do we know, Mike, do you know, or Bruce, I think this is a relevant question, how many teachers who took jabs because they didn't want to be mandated, ended up vaccine injured? Do we know?
No, I'm sorry, I couldn't help you with that, Paul. Although that's a very good question and an important area, that's not an, I've just kept to the lane of the court case.
No, fair enough, yeah.
Yeah, I think Linda Wharton would probably be able to answer that. The other aspect that we haven't really discussed is the whole issue too of the exemption criteria. And, the amount of teachers we know who had things like underlying health conditions, heart-type conditions, and who weren't granted health exemptions. And then we've found that not all the information that came to the court about that was accurate either. There wasn't an expert witness, but nevertheless, the court has been somewhat misled on how many health exemptions were given out.
The serious service disruption exemptions, it wasn't the person that applied, it was the organisation that wanted to keep you on.
Right.
And we now know that there was somewhere between 8,000 and 11,000 applications made by organisations to keep their workers on. We don't know how many people that involved. That information is not yet out.
Yeah.
Because it could be multiple applications for the same person. They might have lasted for 8 weeks and then they applied again. We do not know.
Yeah.
What we do know is the court was led to believe, or the court was told correctly, that at the time of the affidavit that was made, there were only 11 applications for significant service disruption exemptions made or approved, rather. So 11 applications were approved. That was true. What they did not tell the court is that just one of those applications covered 971 workers.
Right.
Yeah. And the total number altogether was approximating 3,000 workers. And so the courts rightly thought there were almost no one, and they talked about the zero tolerance approach. And when the whole question of exemptions came up, the court approvingly noted the government's zero tolerance approach as being one of the reasons why they couldn't holus bolus give exemptions. What would have happened if they'd known that there'd been 3,000 people by that time possibly given significant service disruption exemptions? We don't know.
Yeah, no.
On a brighter note, the Crown lawyers have conceded that Dr. Towns did fail to submit that report to the courts. Of course, they have their own explanation for that, but the fact that they've conceded to that, yeah, gives us a little bit of confidence in going forward with the appeal that this could be the string that starts to unravel the whole thing for us.
Wow. Okay, so what actually happens now then, Mike and Bruce?
Well, we've put in our submission of leave for appeal. The Crown lawyers have responded. There's nothing in it that's surprised us, nothing strong in terms of their counter-argument. And now we just wait to see whether the courts will grant us leave to appeal. Most, I think it's 97%, they turn around within 2 months as to whether they'll grant the appeal. I think our expectation is that the appeal will be, that the leave of appeal will be granted, and then we're back in court, possibly for our last epic battle.
Yeah,
really.
This is the big one.
We can't go any higher than that. Yeah, well, we've been to High Court, Appeal Court, now Supreme Court, and this could be this will probably be the last one, I would think, unless we come back at it again with a whole new case. But that's where we're at now, Paul. And so we'll know within the next couple of months whether we're back in court. And we're hoping that more information, like what our colleague has dug out, Bruce has dug out, will come to fore. But yes, it's really, we want to kind of get the message out to the community that the battle's not over. And it's about the future generations. I mean, most of our teachers have got on with life. They've either retired or some of them have gone, many of them gone back into the workforce and this and that. Some of them are just sick of hearing about it and life goes on. But in terms of future generations, we can't just let this lie. Because it'll be so much more easier for a tyrannical government to impose medical procedures on people without justifiable cause. So we've got to fight it right to the end.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for that, Mike. And Bruce, you got any comments to make before we finish up chatting?
No, I think we've covered most of the important things. I think, just thank you, Paul, for your help in getting this out there so people are aware, and if people can, again, let their MPs know there's information there that they should be aware of. And like, we don't need to wait for the courts. The government, the new government, should be aware by now that things have been done wrong and the ball is in their court to fix it. They don't need to wait for the courts to tell them that. There should be enough information now that everyone knows things were done wrong and it needs to be put right.
I think right at the beginning, you know, we knew it was wrong. It even went against World Health Organization kind of guidelines for schools and that. So there was a sense right from the beginning that it's wrong. And then there's just more and more evidence saying, well, you were right. Yeah, it was wrong.
Mike Shaw and Bruce Gillard from NZTSOS, thank you for coming on this morning to RCR.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.